strong and pay close attention.
Sweet in the morning, I'm sweet, sweet in the morning.
From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today, Susan McDougall, an interview with the woman who spent 18 months in jail for refusing to answer Kenneth Starr's questions. McDougall speaks out about women in prison. Also, it was repeated over and over again. The bombing of the Oklahoma City Federal Building was the worst terrorist act on U.S. soil. What about the U.S. government bombing of Black Wall Street in Tulsa in 1921? Today, an 87-year-old woman who survived Tulsa tells her story. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In the latest in a series of shooting rampages across the country, a man burst into a Jewish community center in Los Angeles suburb and sprayed more than 20 bullets from a high-powered weapon, wounding 5 people, including 3 small children. The suspect in the shooting is still at large. SWAT teams spent several hours searching a hotel last night looking for Buford O'Neill Furrow, but turned up nothing. Police say Furrow walked into the community center with an Uzi-type weapon and sprayed at least 70 rounds. An L.A. police spokesperson says authorities have no motive for the attack. He says police don't know if the center was targeted because the students are Jewish. Meanwhile, a Seattle TV station reports Furrow was sentenced in May to 8 months in the King County Jail for second-degree assault with a deadly weapon, but never reported to jail. The 37-year-old Furrow is also known as Buford O. Furrow, Jr. This news from Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Was a soldier at Fort Campbell bludgeoned to death because of rumors he was gay? An Army investigator is considering testimony suggesting just that and whether a suspect in the death of PFC Barry Winchell should be court-martialed. Winchell was attacked in his barracks July 5th, died the next day of massive head injuries. During a hearing that ended yesterday, 2 sergeants testified that soldiers often taunted the 21-year-old Missouri native because of rumors he was gay. But witnesses also testified they heard the chief suspect in the case threaten Winchell's life after losing a fight at a party July 3rd. The investigator in the case must now recommend how the case will be handled. Possibilities range from no action to referring the case to a general court-martial. And this news from Oak Ridge, Tennessee. The federal government says that 5,600 tons of uranium contaminated with trace amounts of the more radioactive element plutonium were brought to Oak Ridge in the 1950s and 60s for weapons fuel production. The impact on workers and the environment is unknown, but Department of Energy officials promised to investigate. The revelation followed a lawsuit accusing the Department of Energy of silently exposing workers to plutonium over decades at DOE's uranium enrichment plant in Paducah, Kentucky. The Washington Post reported the plutonium eventually contaminated the grounds and spilled into nearby streams and a wildlife refuge. Energy Secretary Bill Richardson Sunday ordered a medical review of current and past workers at Paducah, many of whom are now dead. India and Pakistan today retrieve wreckage from a Pakistani surveillance plane shot down over the border, and each accuse the other of provoking their first aerial clash in nearly 3 decades. An Indian jet fighter shot down the Pakistani naval aircraft over the empty marshes near their disputed border yesterday, reigniting tensions between the hostile neighbors that had barely cooled since an undeclared war this summer. Pakistan said 16 crew members were killed. A senior Indian Air Force officer said parts of the plane sank into the marshes and there appeared little likelihood of finding bodies. The United Nations today promised to push ahead with East Timor's independence referendum, despite former President Carter's accusations that Indonesia's military is undermining the ballot. Senior UN officials convened 2 days of peace talks between rival East Timorese leaders and met with senior Indonesian officials. There are fears that violence, which has already marred preparations for the August 30th ballot, could continue Saturday when the two sides start campaigning for and against independence. In East Timor, the Atlanta-based Carter Center said Indonesian-backed militias had upped a terror and intimidation campaign against independence supporters. Its observers based in East Timor said militias are ignoring an anti-violence code of conduct signed by their leaders and rival pro-independence activists on Monday. The Carter Center said Carter personally contacted Indonesian President B.J. Habibie and complained that senior Indonesian officials, quote, were backing anti-independence militias that have killed dozens of civilians and attacked U.N. staff in a campaign to derail the vote. Serbia's Orthodox Church is repeating its call for Slobodan Milosevic to resign. It says the president is leading Yugoslavia into certain disaster. Meanwhile, here in the United States, Christian Coalition President Pat Robertson said assassinating rogue world leaders would be more practical than the U.S. policy that bans such killings. Robertson made his comments Monday on the 700 Club, a nationally syndicated television show on his Christian broadcasting network. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. When it's Wednesday, it's also Juan Gonzalez, my co-host, but Juan's not in the studio with us today as he prepares to head to Puerto Rico and joins us on the telephone. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and sorry I can't be there personally, but I am leaving in just a little bit heading toward Puerto Rico.
So tell us what you're going to be doing there.
Well, I'm going to be going covering the visit of Reverend Jesse Jackson, who is leaving for Puerto Rico today to get directly involved in the continuing controversy over the situation in Vieques. As we've been reporting on Democracy Now! For quite some time, the conflict between the Puerto Rican people and the U.S. Navy over the continued naval occupation and use of Vieques for target practice has escalated as virtually all the major civic, social, and political leaders of the island have called on the Navy to pull out. And until now, the Navy has refused, or Washington has refused, to listen to those requests. And Reverend Jackson is flying down today along with Dennis Rivera, the leader of the Hospital Workers Union, the SEIU, affiliate of the Hospital Workers Union 1199, to meet with the governor of Puerto Rico. And then on Friday, Reverend Jackson will go to Vieques, where there are several campouts of protesters led by Ruben Berrios, the Puerto Rican Independence Party, and other groups, and he will be meeting with them and showing some solidarity with them, and at least hopefully drawing more U.S. media attention to the issue, because there's been very little in any of the major media in the United States. None of the networks, for instance, have done any coverage of the Vieques situation. So that is... it's a short trip, but it should have some kind of impact in terms of bringing the issue home. Interestingly enough, it comes, Amy, in right after there has been a stunning report that was issued actually in El Nuevo Día in Puerto Rico yesterday. The main Spanish language newspaper on the island reported from Washington, from their Washington correspondent, that there has been a possible breakthrough in the issue of the Puerto Rican political prisoners. the 15 who are in federal prison on seditious conspiracy charges. The Nuevo Dia reported in yesterday's issue that Charles Ruff, the White House counsel, who was basically deliberating and had been deliberating for quite some time the issue of possible pardon, made a recommendation on Friday to President Clinton. Now, El Nuevo Dia is reporting that the recommendation would be for 13 of the 15 prisoners to be pardoned by the president. However, I've tried to talk to people at the White House yesterday. They weren't saying, but they did say that there may be an announcement soon on this issue. I've heard from other sources that it may not be just as Nuevo Dia reported, that there would be an immediate pardon for 13 of the 15, but another source is saying that it may be that there will be an attempt to free the women who have been in prison first, and then some of the others. In other words, that it might be staged pardons.
Juan, two quick questions. You have covered this for years and written columns about the Puerto Rican political prisoners. But overall, you said, for listeners who are not familiar, that they were charged with seditious conspiracy. Can you explain just the overall context for them?
Well, basically, there's actually two groups, because between 1980 and 85, there were a series of arrests by federal agents around the United States and Puerto Rico. Some were accused of being members of the FALN, the Armed Forces of National Liberation. And
who won independence for Puerto Rico.
Right. And the others were accused of being members of the Macheteros, another organization that has been fighting for independence for Puerto Rico for many years and is most known in this country for the Wells Fargo robbery in Hartford, Connecticut, where $7.5 million were taken. And the thing about all of this, folks, is that they've all been convicted of conspiracy, none of an actual participation in a crime or a bombing or the killing of anyone. Yet the sentences average about more than 70 years apiece. Sentences range from 35 to 90 years, and it's about a little over 70 years apiece. Whereas you've got people like the folks who participated in the bombing of the killing of the Chilean ambassador were out after about 15 years, and you had the average sentence for murder in this country is about 22 years, and yet here are people who were never convicted of killing or injuring anyone, who never had any criminal records, and who were clearly motivated by a love of their homeland and wanting Puerto Rico to be independent. They are serving an average of 72 years in prison and their sentences. So that a wide range of people, from Cardinal O'Connor in New York to virtually most of the major political leaders in Puerto Rico, not all but most, from various political persuasions and others around the United States, Coretta Scott King and others, have all called for the release of the prisoners. And this issue of whether President Clinton would grant a pardon has been now on the table for several years.
Why would Charles Ruff care? This is the man who became known, a familiar face to Americans, as the leader of President Clinton's defense in his impeachment trial.
Well, as I understand it, I think Friday was Ruff's last day on the job. And so I think this was something that that had been on his table for quite a while, that needed to be resolved. And of course, you do have the reality that as Al Gore prepares to run for president, and Hillary Clinton possibly prepares to run in the Senate in New York, that to some degree or other, maybe the Clinton administration is attempting to look a little bit more benign before some Latinos in the country, because as I have said, in the Latino community, no matter what your political persuasion, there generally is an agreement that these folks who are considered patriots, even if you may disagree with what they had, what they are convicted of doing, that they've served enough time and deserve to be out of jail. And there are many people, of course, who consider them freedom fighters who never should have been in jail to begin with. The important thing is apparently there is some kind of a breakthrough that will be occurring in the next few days. And, of course, it's just a recommendation from Ruff. The president, if he begins to get pressured from those in the country who see these prisoners as pure terrorists, and that that pardoning them would be a concession to terrorism, will undoubtedly organize and attempt to influence the president as well. So it is apparently at a key moment right now.
Well, Juan, I want to thank you very much for updating us on the situation. Have a safe trip to Puerto Rico with the Reverend Jesse Jackson, and we hope to hear from you this week on Democracy Now! And what comes of the trip.
Very good.
Juan Gonzalez, usually here for the whole show, now headed down to Puerto Rico. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move back in time to another story that certainly has not gotten the coverage that it deserves over the years. On June 1st, 1921, that's 78 years ago, Greenwood, the prosperous African-American community of Tulsa, Oklahoma, was looted and burned by a white mob numbering in the thousands. This came after false rumors that a black man had assaulted a white woman in an elevator and an editorial in the Tulsa Tribune calling for whites to, quote, lynch a nigger tonight. Eyewitness accounts tell of aerial bombing, internment camps for black men, and truckloads of corpses dumped into unmarked mass graves. 35 city blocks were completely destroyed, and experts believe that at least 300 people died. If this is so, then the Tulsa, what's become known as the race riot of 1921, surpasses the Oklahoma City bombing as the largest mass murder of civilians on U.S. soil. And taking place 6 decades before the assault on the MOVE compound in Philadelphia, it was the first bombing of U.S. citizens by agents of the U.S. government. Well, following the 75th anniversary of the massacre, the Tulsa Race Riot Commission was formed to establish an historical record of the massacre, to search for remains of the hundreds of victims, and determine if reparations should be made for the destruction to Tulsa's black business district. Well, this week, the commission held a hearing in Tulsa and listened to testimony from witnesses and survivors, including John Hope Franklin, the head of Clinton's Race Commission, whose father was a survivor of the riot. Well, today we're going to hear from another survivor of that riot, as well as the head of the Oklahoma Historical Society and chair of the Tulsa Race Riot Commission. Bob Blackburn is with us, director of the Historical Society. Welcome to Democracy Now! And welcome to Eldoris Mikandici. Welcome, Eldoris. Let's begin with Eldoris Mikandici, 87 years old, a survivor of the Tulsa riot. She's one of 62 known living survivors of that 1921 event. Can you tell us what happened?
Yes. Well, as I have already stated that I was only 9, but I remember vividly what went on. And it was a very frightening for me. It was very frightening. And I was so afraid at one time that I pulled away from my parents and ran and hid in a chicken coop where gobs of people were trying to avoid bullets that were raining down on us, even though we were leaving our homes. And everyone across the track, there were people, just hundreds of people, leaving home because they were made to leave home or they would be killed on the spot. So as I looked across and saw all of these people, some did not have time to dress. Most didn't have time to dress. Some were in their nightgowns. some people could not find shoes and had to walk out, walking down this track with no shoes, no dress, in their gowns. And it was very, very, very disturbing.
Eldoris Mukandichi, we're going to break for our stations to identify themselves. But when we come back, we'd like you to finish describing what happened so many decades ago, but is what's still vivid in your memory. Eldoris Mukandichi, an 87-year-old survivor of the Tulsa race riot. And we'll speak with Bob Blackburn, director of the Oklahoma Historical Society. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! After we speak with them, Susan McDougall will join us to talk about women in prison. Are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we go back in time to June 1st, 1921, to what has become known as the Tulsa Race Riot, which may, in fact, have included an aerial bombing of what has become known as Black Wall Street. This week, the Tulsa Race Riot Commission held a hearing and listened to testimony from witnesses and survivors. We are joined by one of those survivors right now, Eldoris Mukandichi, who's now 87. We're also joined by the head of the Race Riot Commission, Bob Blackburn. Eldoris Mukandichi, you were describing what you remembered at the age of nine. Now, what is even less well known than the fact that any of this took place in 1921 is that there was some kind of bombing that happened. Do you remember anything like that?
Bombing? Yes, there were our churches, our schools, and any building that was in the Black Street era and on down. This was happening in the south of Tulsa, and this was the people were leaving, going north, and I could just look back and see smoke rolling, and we lost all of our churches except one little frame building that they could not destroy, and businesses where our men had worked and made this, as it was so popular and just such a wonderful thing that they did name it Black Wall Street.
Hmm. And but do you remember seeing airplanes?
Yes. I was under the fire of airplanes. As we were walking away from our home, there were airplanes up above us shooting bullets down. I could see them and hear them falling. Hmm. And this frightened me so until, as I stated before, I left my parents and ran to a little shelter. And my father had to come in and get me. We rejoined the throng that was going north. And I don't know just how far we went, but I know now it was some little town north. And some of the people had no place to go but north, and then wondering what they would find if they got back home. And, of course, they were all disappointed because everything they had worked for was gone. However, as we wandered down the track, night came on, and some good farmer had built another house and he had the house that he lived in. He said he opened it up to as many that could get in this house for the rest of the night. And after that, the next morning, someone told my mother about a family in Pawhuska. And we went, he took us there, and the people received us, gave us a nice place to stay. We stayed there for 2 or 3 days. And after peace was declared in Tulsa, we came back home.
Eldoris Makandishi, 87 years old, survivor of what has become known as the Tulsa Race Riot. Also on the phone with us, Bob Blackburn, director of the Oklahoma Historical Society and chair of the Tulsa Race Riot Commission. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Bob Blackburn.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Well, since we've last spoken, you held these hearings this week. How many people do you estimate died?
Well, based on the official count at the time, which was 76, which included 8 white deaths and 68 African Americans, we did not trust those figures. We had records from cemeteries, from county court, records on gravediggers being hired. We had a lot of eyewitness accounts of seeing people either thrown in the river or buried in mass burial sites. We even had some eyewitness accounts of bodies being thrown in incinerators. And this was such a strong memory in the community, especially in the black community as well as in the white community of Tulsa, that we really allocated a lot of our resources to that effort. And based on archival evidence, on looking at all of the eyewitness accounts, we think we have found 3 mass burial sites in the community. We think there were many more where maybe 1 or 2 people were buried in different places. And we have done some non-invasive archaeological investigations. We've used ground-penetrating radar. We've used electromagnetometer readings trying to find any concentrations. Well, after the outpouring of press in March, when I think I spoke on your network before, we had new eyewitness accounts come forward, and one 10-year-old boy at the time, who was a white boy in Tulsa, saw a burial in one of these cemeteries. He came forward. He says, I remember very distinctly where it was. He took us to it. We had been looking in the wrong place, it turned out. And the point that he spotted turns out to have a large concentration of metal objects about 6 feet underground, about 15 feet wide and 20 feet long. Fits the profile of a mass burial site. We, on Friday, decided to go ahead and proceed with some test excavations to see if it really is skeletal remains. The minute we find out that it is skeletal remains, we will stop, and then we will be much more inclusive with other groups on whatever we do from that point. But we think now between 200 and 300 deaths is not out of the question, based on the population of the time, the intensity of the fighting, and some of the scant records that have survived to this very day.
Now, Bob Blackburn, is it inaccurate to say that a lot of the deaths were caused by aerial bombardment?
No. It could have. A lot of that, though, we think was more setting fire to the properties.
Right.
The airplanes did not come out until dawn on June the 1st. The fighting had begun the previous afternoon, and it was a pitched battle. There were many people in the black community who were trained as soldiers in World War I. In fact, we have accounts that many of the black people went home and put on their uniforms and got their weapons and deployed in skirmish lines and set up points of concentrated fire and defended the district. And the fighting continued throughout the night. The white mobs could not invade. They were not successful in penetrating those defenses. The next morning at dawn is when the mass assault by the white mob occurred. We think that's when the airplanes started coming into the district.
And whose planes were they?
Well, we've discovered that there were 8 airplanes in Tulsa. They were privately owned. None of them were owned by government officials. There were only 2 airplanes in the entire state at the time owned by government. Those were both at Fort Sill, which is about 150 miles away, and could not have even been there in time, even if it started. One was still in the crates. So these were privately owned airplanes, most of them by independent oil men. Because Tulsa was an oil boom town. This was a Wild West,
right,
Tombstone, Dodge City type of town with a wild, very young, very aggressive population of young men who had come looking for jobs. And a lot of those independent oil men had airplanes to go out and look for land leases, to be the first into an oil patch, to check pipelines, whatever. And we have very good corroborating evidence that some of the airplanes were used. We think now that there were guns being fired from some of the airplanes. We think that dynamite was dropped. How much damage? Probably was minimal directly. It was more of a means of terrorism. You know, 30 years later, Hitler and Goering would use airplanes for terrorism bombing. And we think that's what happened in this case. Most of it was used for destroying the district and starting the fires that would spread from the southern part of the Black District along the railroad tracks north.
And Eldoris Mukandichie was just saying that why this is referred to as the area Black Wall Street. Is that the right term to use?
Yes, ma'am. In fact, that term was coined by Booker T. Washington, who visited Tulsa before the riot and saw the prosperity of the district, because we had about 10,000 African-Americans in Tulsa at the time, a very prosperous community, as was the majority white Tulsa across the tracks, because this was an oil boom town, people doing very well. We have established a profile of what that district looked like before the riot, 191 businesses, 15 doctors, chiropractors, dentists, lawyers, hospitals, you know, it goes on and on. We think about 1,500 homes had been built for and by black people. And when the riot was finished, there were only 300 structures standing out of this very prosperous district that Booker T. Washington had admired and saw the prosperity and saw the investment and the diversity. And it was like a small town within a town, because Oklahoma was a segregated society at this time because of the Jim Crow laws.
We're talking to Bob Blackburn, director of the Oklahoma Historical Society and chair of the Tulsa Race Riot Commission, which held a hearing this week into the Tulsa Race Riot of 1921. Also on the line with us from Tulsa, Eldoris Mukandichie. She's 87 now. She was 9 at the time of the riot, and has been describing firsthand what she saw. Eldoris Mukandichie, how did it feel this week to testify and to hear others who survived and talking about their stories? This is something that most people in this country have no idea about.
Well, it wasn't pleasant to hear again, and I have heard it off and on. That wasn't the first time, but having been here and knowing about it, it just brought back memories. But as I said, it's more easy to talk about it now than it would have been earlier in my years, because since then we have come a long way, and it just depends mostly on the people, because we were segregated. But now it's desegregated. We could go just so far. On Archer, the Negro business stopped there. Couldn't go across the tracks. But now, and you could not live where you wanted to live. And with the progress that had been made by the Negroes and the opening up and desegregation, it is more easy to talk about it than it would have been. So this is the way I see it, and it doesn't hurt as much, because it's been so long, and we, as I said, we have come so far, and we are willing and we appreciate this talk about the race riot. Because it was so terrible until at that time, until this, the way we have progressed, we just don't have too much to look back to, because, in a way, because most of the people who own these places, the business places, they are gone. And only just a few that was my age just remember. But we remember, and we were here. But these are our grandchildren. It's just history, I mean, to them. And these young people now know, they don't know too much about it.
But what they know,
they've been told.
They know because of you and others who are here to testify about it.
Right.
Now, Bob Blackburn, can you talk about the internment of African-American men?
Yes, the internment usually is referred to when the National Guard got to the site on the morning of June 1st. They got there about 8:30. They deployed and really started calming down the violence about 9:30 or 10. And many of the African-Americans at the time praised the National Guard as finally ending the violence. And under riot tactics of 1921, when you're faced with an overwhelming majority mob attacking a minority population of whatever color, the tactics are to protect the minority rather than attacking the majority. And so the National Guard strategy was to intern the black population at the time for protection. That was the stated goal, and that was in the reports filed afterwards. And it was consistent with riot control tactics at the time, because you cannot, with a force of only 100 men, you could not face down a mob of 10,000. And so the strategy was to disarm, to take people into custody. And many of the African Americans gladly came out of their concealments, gave up their rifles, because they had been overwhelmed for about 3 hours by that time. And then they were placed in internment camps for protection, and then later treated and released. If I might say one thing about the memory issue that you were talking about, is a painful memory. One thing we noticed 2 years ago when we began this process is that we had two memories in Tulsa, one largely in the African-American community, one largely in the white community. Both were painful memories for different reasons. And we started working to kind of pull that dialogue to the surface. And it took us about a year and a half of hearings and investigations and interviews and working with the community at large until people were comfortable with coming forward. We knew of only 12 survivors when we started the process. We now know of 62. We now have white families who have submitted to us manuscripts written by their grandfathers, people who were in the riot, who were the people carrying the guns and attacking this part of town. People are now willing to talk about it and deal with these issues. One of our goals as a commission is to continue this dialogue, to not do something that sets us back, to make sure that everyone is comfortable in dealing with all of these issues of bringing out all the evidence we can find, of having a healthy dialogue that here was a tragic episode in our history, here are the reasons for it, here's what happened. Now how can we really promote reconciliation? Divides across ethnicity and racial divides.
Which brings us to really this last point of where does this investigation go from here? Yours is an independent commission, right? The Tulsa Race Riot Commission. What about the state legislature?
Well, we were created by the state legislature. It was a majority vote in both the House and Senate, and the governor signed the bill creating our commission and funded us. We would not have been able to make any progress without any funding, but our goal is by January 1st to submit a report to the legislature with recommendations on our findings, with what we think should happen next. And we are to consider the issue of reparations, which can range all the way from a museum exhibit or a scholarship fund, as was used in Rosewood, Florida, or it could be direct payments to descendants.
Eldoris Mukandashi, what would you like to, how would you like to be repaid, or what kind of reparations do you feel would be appropriate?
Well, at my age, it's fine, but I mean to be paid, and what I think about the program, it's very interesting and it's very good, but John Hope Franklin mentioned something that he would like to see. Is this what you want? That he would like to see this go further than just the United States. Is that what you ask?
That's interesting.
The question that you ask, I mean, is that pertaining to the question that
sure.
you asked?
Sure. What did he say he would like to see in terms of it?
He'd like to see this all over, this race riot and all of that happened. He'd like to see it all go all over the world. instead of just here in the United States.
That the story be heard all over.
Yes, and then he had interesting thing to say, but I just didn't get it all.
Right,
but
John Hope Franklin.
One of his main reasons for it, then a Tulsa. However, his family didn't move here until after the riot.
But his father was
his father
a survivor.
Was here as a lawyer, yes, very prominent lawyer.
And he helped a number of the black Tulsans who had survived the riot.
Yes.
I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Bob Blackburn, who is the chair of the Tulsa Race Riot Commission, which was impaneled by the Oklahoma State Legislature, and Aldoris McCondishy, survivor of the Tulsa Riot of June 1921. Bob Blackburn, if people want to get in touch with the commission, where can they call or go on the web?
Well, they can call us here at the Oklahoma Historical Society. The phone number is 405-522, and I'll give you my phone number, 5240. We also have a website for the commission. It's on the website for the Oklahoma Historical Society if someone has a search engine, or it is at www.ok-history.mus for museum.ok.us. And we have all of our minutes and agendas posted. We have some of our oral testimony already posted on it so people can read some of the interviews we're doing with the survivors. And our report will be posted on the Internet by January 1st.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Aldoris McCondishy, a survivor, and Bob Blackburn, director of the Oklahoma Historical Society. And again, his phone number, 405-522-5240. And I'm sure if you or a family member, a grandfather or a great-grandfather or perhaps a parent survived the Tulsa Race Riot of 1921, especially if you have that kind of firsthand experience, if you can call the Oklahoma Historical Society, I'm sure it would be a tremendous help as they compile their report. Well, that does it for this segment of the program, and special thanks to our producer, David Love, who's been doggedly following the story and first brought it to us, to our attention well before it was in the national newspapers. When we come back from our break, we'll be joined by Susan McDougall. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Stay with us. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. Manacles and chains, that may be the picture you conjure up when you think of Susan McDougall. Imprisoned for murder? No, she merely refused to answer questions from a federal grand jury as part of Kenneth Starr's investigation of President Clinton. For that crime, she was imprisoned for contempt of court and obstruction of justice for 18 months. A federal jury did acquit her of the charges. Kenneth Starr said just a few months ago he would drop all charges against two women he'd accused of hindering his investigation of President Clinton, but was unable to convict in trials that ended in bitter setbacks for the independent counsel's office. Starr said he would not seek to retry Susan McDougall, who is a central figure in his long-running investigation of President Clinton's Arkansas real estate ventures like Whitewater. The other figure was Julie Hyatt Steele, a more peripheral figure in the White House sex scandal. Susan McDougall was acquitted in Arkansas on April 12th of obstructing justice for refusing to testify before a grand jury about the financial dealings of the president and Hillary Clinton in their pre-presidential life. But the jury deadlocked on two charges of criminal contempt, And Starr's office was thought until late May to be mulling whether to retry McDougal on those counts. In her case, Starr did file a dismissal motion with Judge George Howard Jr. of U.S. District Court in Little Rock, Arkansas, telling the court it would be very difficult to impanel a new jury whose views were not contaminated by extensive publicity. And now Ken Starr is wrapping up his investigation that has taken many millions of dollars and a number of years. Well, we're joined right now from Arkansas by Susan McDougal, and we welcome you to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
It's good to be with you. And
well, it's nice to be with you, too. It's nice to be anywhere.
And it's good to be talking with you as a free woman, as opposed to behind bars. Well, Susan McDougal, you have made it a central cause now, since you've been free, to start to go around the country and talk not about the Whitewater investigation, not about Ken Starr, but to talk about the condition of women in U.S. prisons.
That's true. I've been doing that since I got out of trial about 4 months ago.
What are you saying?
Well, I think people would be shocked to know how people are held in jails. I was really shocked. I had no idea. When I went to my first jail, and I heard the screams and the cries of the men being raped, and the policy at that time of the sheriff's office was to wait until the fight had died down before he sent people in to calm it down so his people wouldn't get hurt. And you could hear them screaming and crying and begging. And it was unmistakable what was going on as we sat below and listened to it. And then that was one jail where men were housed close to me. Other than that, people are hungry. The mentally ill are terribly abused, because the jails are not equipped, and because we don't have a mental illness policy in this country about what happens to the mentally ill, they're just being housed in our jails. And they are terribly abused by guards who are not equipped to deal with the mentally ill and who find that the only thing to do is use force. And they're often locked away in cells. They don't feed themselves. They lose enormous amounts of weight. They get sicker and sicker as they're held in there. And I saw this with my own eyes. In one jail, I was held on the same floor as the people who were mentally ill. And I saw it happen. I saw them beaten. I saw them not feed themselves. I saw one woman try to hang herself. It was just other inmates who saw it and prevented it. I mean, it's really bad. Not to say that it should be cushy for people who've committed crimes, but it does, who might have committed crimes, because in our jails, the people are just accused of having committed crimes. That's one thing I could never get across to the jailers. You know, everyone in here is innocent until proven guilty. But not to say it should be cushy, but, you know, I thought the purpose was to, you know, put people in jail and deprive them of their freedom, not to, you know, make it a horror to be there. I mean, I was in jails where roaches would fall from the ceiling onto your face while you were sleeping at night. I don't mean one. I mean many. You had to fight the roaches off your food in the morning when they would push the tray under the door. And I just didn't know things like that existed in this country. And I think people are as shocked as I am and need to know what's going on. And it's the fastest growing industry in America. I'm not talking about some small thing. I'm talking about what we're spending most of our tax dollars for. California in the last 10 years has spent more money on jails than on higher education. And that's the one state that the criminal justice logs have records of. It is a huge industry. It's becoming the fastest growing industry in all the states.
And in California, the prison guard lobby, I believe, is the second most powerful lobby
union.
In the state.
It's the second most powerful union, and they spend enormous amounts of money. And now we're getting private jails because the states just don't want to deal with it anymore. And the horrors, not that I was ever in one, but the horrors that you read about those, where, you know, private citizens are running jails for our country, I just can't believe it's happening. And I'm doing is raising consciousness at this point, and I'm gathering volunteers who want to go into the jails, especially for women. Is what we've seen happen, and I don't think this is any big surprise, is male prisoners keep their wives and girlfriends usually while they're in, and they support them, they send them money, they report abuses. But women, by and large, once they are incarcerated, lose their family. They lose their husband or their boyfriend. They don't come to visit. I was recently at a conference where they were saying what a network the male prisoners had of the wives who would report anything that happened, and, you know, they would report it to the to the chaplains, and things were getting done. And they said, but it just hadn't happened for the women. I said, well, why do you think that is? Because men leave. They don't stick around once their wife isn't able to do the things that men expect them to do. And that's one of the reasons those women are in jail in the first place. Most of the women I met while I was in jail were there because of the male in their relationship. And it's just a continuing pattern of abuse. I think Amnesty International is doing a USA report, and it's a fabulous report. Anyone who would like to read it should go on Internet and look up AmnestyInternational.com and read this report. It says that 97% of women in jail were sexually abused before they ever got there, and it's just a continuing pattern. And that's one thing I was very ignorant of. I had no idea of those numbers, but that absolutely coincides with what I saw when I was in jail and the women that I met there. And that's one reason I've become such an activist about it, because something's got to be done to protect our young women. They're 80% of them don't ever graduate from high school because of the abuse in their lives. They leave home, they leave school, and they hit the road, and they start on a life of crime. And something's got to be done early to save these girls before we lose them.
We're talking to Susan McDougall, who spent 18 months in prison.
22 months.
22 months, so almost 2 years. And I can tell, as you certainly describe the miserable conditions, that every month, to say the least, mattered. What could you do as a prisoner to help other prisoners?
Well, one of the things that happened early on, not because I thought of it, but because the women came to me, was they wanted me to hold a religious service in for them. And what developed out of that, because of my life at that point, was seeking a higher power and also talking about ourselves as women. And I started women's talk groups in every jail I was in, where we would sit at night and talk about how we got here, what our fears are. And the thing that came through to me more than anything was the self-hatred. I mean, far from not accepting responsibility, which is, you know, the watchword of the 90s for all these right-wing crazos, is accept personal responsibility. Women tend to accept responsibility not just for what they have done, but for what has been done to them. I mean, they felt responsible for every rape, for every molestation, for every abuse that had come to them. They felt responsible. And one of the things I worked on more than anything else was just forgiving ourselves and going forward. Because you can't go forward in your life if you're full of self-hatred. And these women hate themselves. They hate what they've done to their children. They hate what has been done to them, and they feel responsible for their father or their brother or whoever who did this, because they think in some way they might have enticed them or encouraged them. And the hatred, the self-hatred, is something that I worked really hard to make them see that they have got to get past that.
I think I'm beginning to understand why you were finally let out of prison. You were perhaps a more formidable force the federal authorities had to deal with in prison than outside.
I was charged with inciting a riot my last week. Almost charged. They threatened me with inciting a riot over an abuse that I saw happening in front of my eyes, and I had the whole unit, you know, the whole unit of women standing together and saying, we just won't tolerate this.
Which prison were you in?
I had gotten to the point where I didn't even recognize myself. You know, I had, when I first went to jail, I was one person. And by the end of that 2 years, I was somebody else. I didn't even recognize myself. I was so carried away by what I was seeing happen to human beings in America. I couldn't, it was something I thought might happen in some third world country. And that's why in the 4 months I've been out of trial, I've sort of dedicated my time to telling people what's happening. And I never have spoken to any group yet that hasn't responded with, I can't believe that that is happening.
Susan McDougall, if you knew what you were going to experience for going to prison for refusing to cooperate with Kenneth Starr, would you do it again?
I wouldn't take one day away. I'm a better person today. I'm a better person. And I know more, and in things that I never would have known had I not gone. I wouldn't take away one day of it. I would, in fact, I was in a jail yesterday. I went to visit my very first jail yesterday, and it was everything I could do to walk out that door when I left the women there.
Which was that jail?
Faulkner County in Conway, Arkansas. I went back to see if some of the things, actually, I have been talking about that jail quite a bit, and the sheriff asked to meet with me he said he was very upset about the things I was saying. This is a new sheriff, not the sheriff that was there when I was there. And he wanted to show me that, yes, he knew that those things had occurred and he was working on it. And I went to see yesterday. And it was everything I could do not to just stay there. And I told him, I said, I feel such a sense of wanting to care for you. As these women are it's the same women I encountered in jail after jail. Hopeless. They hadn't talked with their attorneys. One woman has been there since the 2nd of last month and has still not talked to one person about when she's to be arraigned, what's to happen to her, and what she's looking for in terms if she's convicted, which she will be because she doesn't have a lawyer. What will happen to her and what will happen to her children whom she will lose next month if she doesn't get acquitted? I mean, it's time after time you see these women have no help. Families desert women when they get in trouble. Because women should be home, they should be baking cookies, they shouldn't be in trouble in the first place. And the stigma that attaches to a woman in trouble is unbelievable. And the partner doesn't want to hang around. He's got other fish to fry, and he's out of there. And the sense of hopelessness is just overwhelming. I couldn't help but just, I was so overcome yesterday. And they were saying, you must not have much of a life on the outside. they were laughing. I said, I can't stand to leave you. And they said, you must not have much of a life out there. But the truth of the matter is, it is the most useful I've ever felt in my life. I never felt I had always taken care of myself and my family, but I had never had anything that I really cared about. And now I truly care about these women, and I see the desperation in their lives and how hard they're working to overcome it.
Considering you went to prison to protect President Clinton, refusing to cooperate with his chief tormentor, the independent prosecutor, Kenneth Starr, it sounds like you would have direct access to the president now that you're out. Will you be speaking to him, have you, and will you raise this issue and make some demands?
You know, I haven't spoken with him, and one of the reasons I haven't is because it never was about Bill Clinton for me. This is truly a man that was ruining lives to bring down the government. And I happen to be very close not only to my family that he brought before the grand jury and threatened, but friends that I'd known all my life.
You're talking about Starr, not
Kenneth
Clinton.
Starr. And it was truly about Kenneth Starr for me. It could have been an investigation about you, you know, and I still wouldn't have done it. It didn't have a thing to do with Bill Clinton or the presidency. And so I've sort of distanced myself from that because I want people to understand this isn't right for anybody, much less the president of the United States. But it wouldn't be right for your next-door neighbor to go through the kind of investigation and the kind of intimidation of witnesses that Kenneth Starr did on the president of the United States. It shouldn't happen to anybody. And that's why I went to jail. And I know people are interested because it involves Bill Clinton. But, you know, people should care. If that happened to anybody, we should care that a prosecutor would use those kind of tactics against someone in our country.
Well, Susan McDougall, we have to wrap up, and I want to know if you've started an organization or have a contact on the web or phone number that people can call if they're concerned about women in prison.
Well, my lawyer's number is 213-250-5055, and he's helping me to coordinate because we don't have a foundation set up yet. I wanted to see what sort of interest there was. I was afraid no one would care. But that just isn't true. People do care, and people do want to help. And I thank you for the time to talk about that. And you know, Starr is back in the news with this report he's going to issue. And I am so furious about it because it is so patently political. And people should call his office in Washington, D.C., the Office of Independent Counsel, and complain about that. Because that is truly wrong. It's once again our tax dollars paying for a political persecution.
Well, I want to thank you again, Susan McDougall, for joining us from Arkansas.
Thank
and we hope to
time.
Be speaking with you again about your crusade around women in prison.
Thanks.
And hopefully perhaps some money can get there, maybe from all the money also the president's raised in his defense fund to be diverted to help women in prison. And Ken Starr hasn't stopped his investigations. He's now investigating the investigative reporter Murray Wass, who has been reporting on what has been going on internally in independent counsel Kenneth Starr's meetings with his chief prosecutors. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by David Love and Maria Carrion. Bernard White is our engineer, Errol Maitland, our technical director. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!